You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. In the dynamic world of enterprise security, identity architects and IT leaders face a major challenge. Growth by repeated acquisitions multiplies the complexity of everything. Multiple IDPs, MFA providers, policy engines that all need to coexist. This can lead to fragmented user identities and policies that create security vulnerabilities and add access friction. Strata Identity solves this. Now you can decommission unneeded IDPs and consolidate the ones you'd like to keep without rewriting apps or disrupting users, engineers, and app owners. Plus, Strata's modular architecture makes it easy to integrate with any identity provider without manual maintenance and coding. Join the ranks of cybersecurity leaders using identity orchestration. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your top identity security priorities, and receive a pair of complimentary AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations with over 5,000 employees. Step into a new era of identity management at strata.io/cyberwire. Kaseya continues to work through remediation of the VSA vulnerability exploited by R-Evil, with completion expected Sunday afternoon. And while R-Evil has made a nuisance of itself, this time they may not have seen a big payday, at least not yet. The U.S. is still considering its retaliatory and other options in the big ransomware case. China's MSS is active against targets in Asia. Andrea Little-Limbago from Interos looks at government access to data analysis. Our guest is Leon Gilbert from Unisys with data from their Digital Workplace Insights report. And scammers are baiting their hooks with Black Widow lures. From the CyberWire studios at DataTribe, I'm Dave Bittner with your CyberWire summary for Friday, July 9th, 2021. We begin with an update on R-Evil's exploitation of Kaseya's VSA. Kaseya CTO Dan Timpson posted a video late yesterday afternoon in which he provided a high-level overview of the steps the company was taking to fix the problems with its VSA software, whose modular design he credited with helping limit the scope of the attacks by R-Evil. Timpson made a point of listing the organizations Kaseya was working with as it responded to the ransomware attack: Mandiant, including its affiliate FireEye, the FBI, CISA, and DIVD, as well as with partners, customers, and researchers. Kaseya has fixed the vulnerabilities in both on-premises and cloud versions of VSA, he said, documented the updates, and had them peer-reviewed by the partners the company has engaged. A post on Kaseya's site indicates that patches for VSA's on-premises version are still scheduled for release this coming Sunday, July 11th, at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. That's also when Kaseya intends to begin deploying the fixes to its VSA software-as-a-service infrastructure. There's some question as to how successful the responsible R-Evil affiliate has actually been this time around. It's clearly succeeded at infecting both direct customers of Kaseya as well as those customers' customers, the downstream victims of nth-party risk. The Wall Street Journal reports that ransomware infestations connected with the exploitation of Kaseya had, by yesterday, been found in 6 European countries. The Record reports that Kaseya's president and general manager for EMEA, Ronan Kirby, addressing a meeting convened by Belgium's CERT, those 6 countries were the UK, the Netherlands, Germany, Sweden, Norway, and Italy. 8 of the 60 direct customers affected by the campaign are in Europe. Kaseya still thinks there are between 800 and 1,500 total downstream victims, that is, customers of the MSPs who use Kaseya's VSA. But it's not clear how well the extortionists have actually done in collecting the ransom they've demanded. Bleeping Computer has found only 2 victims who've paid any ransom at all, and so concludes that the responsible R-Evil affiliate is unlikely to get the big payday they're hoping for. R-Evil went after the software itself, the better to cast a broad net, and so passed up the now customary step of wiping or encrypting backups. So the victims may have simply opted to restore from backups and bite the bullet on any doxing that may develop later. Unless, of course, there's some under-the-radar GoFundMe campaign that's quietly raising the $50 million the bad guys want. No, that's not going to happen. A U.S. response to the ransomware campaign remains under consideration. Security Week writes that the U.S. administration faces pressure to do something about R-Evil's campaign, and it's clear that doing something increasingly means taking a whack at Russian interests, with U.S. military organizations doing a good bit of the whacking. The Pentagon has been circumspect about what it might be called upon to do. A Defense Department spokesman on Tuesday declined to discuss specific U.S. Cyber Command capabilities, plans, or infrastructures. The spokesman said, quote, "We are all mindful of these growing threats to national security as well as to civilian infrastructure. We believe a U.S. response to those threats has got to be whole of government," end quote, as opposed to a purely military response. In this case, whole of government would probably mean, especially, the intelligence community and the departments of state, justice, treasury, and commerce. More coverage of this incident can be found on our CyberWire website. Recorded Future's InSICT group reports finding what appears to be a Chinese cyber espionage campaign active against targets in Nepal, Taiwan, and the Philippines. The threat group, which Recorded Future tracks as Threat Activity Group 22, Tag 22, is interested in telecommunications, academic research and development, and government organizations in the 3 countries. It's also taken an interest in an airport and a university located in Hong Kong. The researchers believe Tag 22 used compromised GlassFish servers and Cobalt Strike for initial access, subsequently switching to its own bespoke backdoors for long-term persistence. They see some overlap with other activity other research groups have tracked. In particular, the infrastructure and the malware used against the targets in Hong Kong are significantly similar to WinT Group activity reported by ESET and NTT Group. There are also some commonalities with the operation against the Mongolian Certificate Authority, MONPASS, that Avast described, especially the deployment of Cobalt Strike. The ShadowPad and WinT backdoors that were used to establish persistence have been used by the operators FireEye calls APT-41 and that Microsoft calls Barium. WinT has been a particular favorite of contractors working for China's MSS, its Ministry of State Security. The different operations have different objectives, but the campaign against targets in Taiwan seems most clearly focused on industrial espionage pursued in the interest of furthering Beijing's economic goals. Microsoft has issued a clarification regarding the patch it issued this week for the CVE-2021-34527 Windows Print Spooler vulnerability, that's Print Nightmare. Redmond says the patch is working as designed and urges users to apply it. The Microsoft Security Response Center investigated reports that the patch was ineffective and concluded that, quote, "All reports we have investigated have relied on the changing of default registry settings related to point and print to an insecure configuration, end quote. And finally, devotees of the Marvel Universe, are you looking forward to the new Black Widow movie? It premieres today, you know. Of course, you know, moviegoers, we are not judging. There's no shame in being a fan. Some of us may already have our tickets. But use caution and discretion when you enjoy. Tech Republic and others are circulating a warning, courtesy of Kaspersky, that scammers are baiting their hooks with a lot of Black Widow bait. Steer clear, especially, of offers of early, free, or pirated streaming of the flick. Movies aren't distributed via executables attached to an email, nor does watching one normally require you to reveal your name, address, passwords, grandmother's maiden name, and so on. As always, viewer beware.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its zero-trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust Plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zero-trust-AI. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
Coming out of the pandemic, workplace conversations are shifting to office reopenings, who's coming back and how often. And many employees report they like the flexibility of working from home and having more control over their schedules. The folks at Unisys recently published results from their latest Digital Workplace Insights report, which looks into these issues. Leon Gilbert is Senior Vice President and General Manager of Digital Workplace Services at Unisys, and he joins us with their findings.
The creation of the report really came from where is the world going post-COVID? Right? We all knew that eventually, the vaccine would come along, and we wanted to, sponsor this report to say, okay, well, where's the world going to go with regards to work? What are people going to do after, the vaccine is complete and people start to think about what does work look like going forward? So that was our rationale for thinking about, let's do this piece of research and let's think about, what is next for digital workplace and next for employees of companies.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting report for sure. One of the things that struck me was more than once, there's some disconnects between what the employees are saying are important to them and what the business leaders are saying are important to them, or at least how they're coming at some of these questions. Can you take us through some of those things that you found?
Yeah, no, I think it's a very valid question. I think you look at some of those responses where you see the business leader says one thing and the employee says something else. But I think there are some as well, Dave, where there's a correlation. But there are absolutely some where if I take for example one of them where I think 51% of business leaders and but 64% of employees agree that a work location schedule is most conducive to family life and an ideal experience, right? But, it's only 50% of those business leaders, but 64% of the employees. So there is definitely a gap there. I think if I think about this on a more holistic basis, I think the race for talent in this global economy is huge. And business leaders really need to start to really understand what their employees are looking for, and what benefits and that actually benefits them. It's no longer just a monetary discussion in my mind. I was reading something yesterday that said that I think people, even with a $30,000 salary increase, they would rather actually work from home than actually get the monetary increase, which I found, astounding when I sat back and thought about it. But actually, it's true. I think people, have found that they haven't skipped a beat since they've actually been at home, which has been hugely beneficial for companies. And I think it's opened a lot of people's eyes out. But there is still some thought process there that, people have to be in the office. For me, Dave, I think it is a mix, right? You're going to get what I would term a hybrid, where you have some in the office, some at home, and you maybe do 2 days on, 3 days off. And I think that also, benefits both employee and employer. And I think that's where I see this industry, I see, the economy and the kind of world going. Yes, for sure, Dave, you're going to get some companies where it's 5 days a week back in the office, thinking about banking, financial institutions, but others, right, I think will be a lot more flexible, and they should be if they want to retain and attract the talent.
Yeah, some of the other findings in the report that were particularly interesting to me were you focused on communications between employers and business leaders and how both of them value communication, but some it seemed like the leaders were having a little more challenge with communication than some of the employees were.
Yeah, I think with the advent of all of what we term the collaboration and communications tools. Let's just take Zoom as an example, right? Zoom isn't just about talking to your grandmother and doing fitness classes, right? It's the way that people have learned to communicate through this pandemic. But I think it's the way that people will start to primarily will communicate going forward, whether it's Zoom or other platforms, Teams example. But to me and to us as an organization, what is crucial is that companies need to start thinking about what is that experience, right? The two people aren't left in a disparity, right? We want digital parity, but we also want experience parity. I think that was one thing that we saw during the research is, and what's important to us is around the experience parity and whether you're in an office, whether you're at home, that you are, you have that same experience of those tools. And, and how you start to, you don't want it where if you're in the office, it doesn't work as well as at home. One thing we have to remember, Dave, when people start to go back to the office and start to use these tools, many offices weren't built for 200 people suddenly on video, right? Mm. So their network isn't necessarily strong enough, if you think about that. So companies are going to have to start thinking about their bandwidth. How do they measure that? And does that cause a disparity between those who are actually at home versus those who are in the office? So there's lots of factors to kind of in this new hybrid world.
That's Leon Gilbert from Unisys. There's a lot more to this conversation. If you want to hear more, head on over to CyberWire Pro and sign up for Interview Selects, where you get access to this and many more extended interviews.
Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging and time-consuming. Enter Vanta. Vanta gives you one place to centralize and scale your security program. Quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for ISO 27001, SOC 2, and more. You can leverage Vanta's market-leading trust management platform to unify risk management and secure the trust of your customers. Plus, use Vanta AI to save time when completing security questionnaires. CyberWire daily listeners can get $1,000 off by going to vanta.com/cyber. That's vanta.com/cyber. We'll be right back.
And joining me once again is Andrea Little-Limbago. She is Vice President of Research and Analysis at Interos. Andrea, it's always great to have you back. I want to check in with you today on, I think, what we can perceive as being a growing trend of government access to data and this whole notion of, do governments need back doors or not? What can you share with us today?
Yeah, I just completed a study looking at the country level, what governments are doing in the area of mandating government access to data. And so you can think about, on the one hand, you know, we hear an awful lot, you know, every single day about, you know, about governments hacking into other systems and going in illegally. But for across the globe, we're really starting to see a growing trend of governments basically putting within their cybersecurity and internet laws the mandate that they can access data when they want to. And it ranges, I mean, there's a whole spectrum of, you know, from very well codified rule of law, we need to have access, we need to show a warrant, and then we want to have access within very discrete circumstances, to basically, you know, non-transparent. If a government comes to a company that is based in that country and says, we need this data, you are required by law to turn it over. And so it has huge private sector implications. And that's, you know, one of the aspects that I really wanted to look at was, you know, as, you know, the private sector is starting to think about where they're located across the globe in different ways than they used to previously, you know, looking at how the regulatory frameworks of those countries should impact those decisions. And I look at this as, you know, yet another cyber risk when thinking about you know, your global footprint. So it is something that is growing with more and more countries starting to require that kind of access.
And to be clear here, I mean, we're talking about democracies, right? I mean, this, different democracies are treating this in different ways.
So it's across the board. And so that's where I'd say, so on the one hand, you know, you have democracies that are not at all allowing a lot of this, or if they do, it's a scalpel, very transparent, all the way over to, you know, China has their law that actually was interesting, that the U.S. National Counterterrorism, our Counterintelligence and Security Center, actually tweeted about China's laws on, if you are a company and you're based in China, here's some legal frameworks you need to be aware of as far as their security laws require access to that data. And so I think it's actually interesting that, you know, we have counterintelligence aspects of our government warning about other countries' laws and access to it. But those are kind of the extremes. But, you know, within the last few days, Mauritius, which is a fairly solid democracy, if you look at, like, on, you know, Freedom House and other kinds of democracy scales, they're a pretty solid democracy. And they just announced that they're exploring basically putting a certificate on all the laptops to do sort of, you know, like a man in the middle kind of access to encrypted data and decrypting it and having just complete access across the board if they want to.
And where is this?
In Mauritius.
Wow.
So that's, you know, one of the ones that kind of, like, to me is a striking outlier, because it is, you know, a fairly solid democracy, but then it's taking in these tools of the authoritarian playbook. And that's what we see more and more. We see these tools being brought in. You know, India is another good example where you have sort of this push towards, you know, greater data protection, but at the same time, internet blackouts, more surveillance going on, even greater concerns about those kinds of information access and control. And so it's really, you know, it's something absolutely keep an eye on. When we talk about the regulatory frameworks that are going on, we often think about data privacy laws, and that's great. Those are absolutely something that for companies and, you know, governments to be aware of. But sort of the reverse is there true, where, you know, under the auspices of, you know, greater security, national security, and so forth, you may have to turn over your data. And it's not just your data. You know, it's not just, you know, asking here and there for perhaps for, like, social media access and passwords and so forth. You know, at times it's source code. That's, you know, and Russia has the source code requirement. And so companies have had to do that. And so that's, it diffuses across the globe. And I think that's probably one of the more troubling aspects of it, is that, you know, these models and these tactics don't just stay, you know, within your, you know, the four you think about, you know, China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran. But those tactics really are starting to get adopted elsewhere. I mean, Vietnam has a very strict cybersecurity law they passed in 2019 for much larger surveillance, you know, forcing governments and companies to comply with data access when approached. You know, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, like, it's a growing number that are really starting to apply a whole range of tools. And, you know, some of it's for censorship and some of it is for greater surveillance. But at the end of the day, for private companies that are, you know, doing business in that those parts of the world, you know, it's just another risk they need to be aware of.
Right. How much of this, you know, for a global company who has, you know, their hand in businesses around the world, how much of this is based on geography and how much is this is based on sort of citizenship? You know, GDPR famously reaches out to European citizens, regardless of where they are?
Yep. Yeah, no, that's a good question. For a lot of these idioms, within their own territory only. And so that's where you sort of the notion of digital sovereignty or cyber sovereignty, where the governments want to have the control of that information within their own borders. What we're seeing, though, and this is recently, we'll see what happens with China and their companies, you know, they're forbidding as well now their foreign companies for turning over data abroad. And so it's almost the reverse going on too now. So it, you know, at the end of the day, it's for control. And so for GDPR, it's, you know, it's protecting their citizens. So it's the flip side of it. For some of these other countries, it's really just complete information control as far as they possibly can, but with a pure, you know, with a focus really on their own, within their own domestic borders. And then that's the argument. And the concern really is not only that, you know, it's going on there and that other countries may adopt that kind of model, but there's also, you know, these countries are also taking and having bigger power in some of the international organizations that shape the standards and norms. And so you see this, when you hear about the push for cyber sovereignty at the UN, for example, it's for pushing for more of these kind of norms that allow governments to do whatever they want within their borders, have complete access and so forth, all in their auspices of sovereignty, when really it's for, you know, controlling the narrative and controlling the information. And if those are the kind of norms and laws that are, you know, the policies that start getting passed at the IGOs, that also becomes troublesome.
Yeah, I'm imagining an extreme situation where we start seeing data centers being installed in embassies.
Well, I mean, so that's a big issue, where the data centers are, right? I mean, that's it absolutely has huge implication for the data centers, especially when you start thinking about some of the data localization requirements and the local data storage. But yeah, where the data centers are is going to, I think that's also going to be a big component as far as starting to think about, you know, where your risks are and knowing where your data is even flowing through and what kind of access there is in those areas.
All right. Well, Andrea Little-Limbago, thanks for joining us.
All right. Thanks, Dave.
And that's the CyberWire. For links to all of today's stories, check out our daily briefing at thecyberwire.com. If you need some companionship while you're puttering around the house this weekend, check out Research Saturday and my conversation with Daniel Katz from Norton LifeLock. We'll be discussing their research, encrypted chat apps doubling as illegal marketplaces. That's Research Saturday. Check it out. The CyberWire podcast is proudly produced in Maryland out of the startup studios of Data Tribe, where they're co-building the next generation of cybersecurity teams and technologies. Our amazing CyberWire team is Elliot Peltzman, Peru Prakash, Justin Sabi, Tim Nodar, Joe Kerrigan, Carol Terrio, Ben Yellen, Nick Vilecki, Gina Johnson, Bennett Moe, Chris Russell, John Petrick, Jennifer Iben, Rick Howard, Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here next week. And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.